ethics. It is, must be February 13th because tomorrow is Valentine's Day. Hope you've all gotten your Valentine's. Thank you. A couple of things. I'm hoping some of our senators will be joining us shortly. This is a somewhat, for the students in the room, this is a somewhat unusual day. We're doing an informational hearing on the initiative process. And we do have a handful of students from the University of Oregon. And their names are Don Coleman, Tara Burke, Stephanie McShirley, Brittany Cromholm, J.P. Bombardier. Did I get that right?
No.
What is it?
Bombardier.
Oh, Bombardier. Oh, man, I really blew that one. Adam Roosevelt got that one right, right? David Gerber and Ed Weeks. So welcome, you guys. Hope you're are you here at the Capitol all day today? Just for this hearing? Holy smokes. Okay. We better get our other state senators here then. All right. We're making calls. And so this may be our last hearing for this very special supplemental session. We don't know that yet. We may be getting another bill or two from the House. So we're on pins and needles, but after today we'll only be meeting on an on-call basis. So with that, I'm going to open an informational meeting and invite Senator Morris up because he's feeling a little under the weather. So we're going to get him on. And Senator Morris, I really appreciate you joining us this afternoon.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to visit today. For the record, Frank Morris, State Senator, District 8, Lynn and Benton Counties. The initiative process is one that has interested me ever since I have come to the legislature. And, in fact, it was one of the first things that I did was to look at the impacts of initiatives and try to understand those in light of the fiscal crisis that we had in 2003 in that session, and in fact carried over into 2005, and have come to some conclusions about the initiative process that, first, I believe that we would be better served to try to figure out how to improve the initiative process rather than to strengthen it rather than diminish it. And there are those that would like to change it to the extent that it really does diminish direct democracy. But I think that, by and large, will fall on deaf ears, because it is clear to me, very clear to me, that the fifth estate of Oregon politics is here to stay. It is not going away. And, of course, the initiative process does have value in that it can force the legislature into a place that maybe it would not otherwise go, in the fact or in the occasion that the legislature really does not reflect the will of the majority of Oregonians. So it does have a role, and it can be very positive. However, the initiative process, it has significant liabilities, and I would share with you third paragraph in my presentation. And those liabilities focus around fiscal impacts. Dramatic changes in fiscal policy through initiatives are not without consequences. And for example, in the last biennium, 27% of discretionary spending was set by voter initiatives. And between 1989 and 2007, discretionary spending increased by $7 billion, a fact that is lost on many voters. But the voter initiatives accounted for $3.4 billion, representing nearly 50% of the spending growth. And by the way, these numbers come out of our legislative revenue and legislative fiscal office. The biggest weakness in the initiative process, occurs to me, is that voters are asked to make a decision in a vacuum. Once a measure is certified, the battle is then joined around 30-second sound bites, either for or against the measure, and voters are quite unable to weigh the added new cost of the initiative against the cost of maintaining existing programs. And to implement initiatives that have huge fiscal impacts with the assumption that we will grow our way into that funding by the growth of our economy and increasing in revenue is one that historically shows us not to be the case. For example, the recession we had in 2002, when $2.4 billion of expected revenue disappeared from the forecast. in fiscal year 2002, which represented 20.3% of our discretionary spending at that time. So there are consequences. And what I would suggest is that the history of initiatives in Oregon has indeed proven that our electorate cannot have it both ways. And I recognize that for a politician to push back to voters is not a popular place to be. But I think we need to call it the way it is. And that has most notably been demonstrated in the effects that initiatives have had on higher education funding in Oregon. In real dollar decline, we've had a 36% decline in funding for higher education from 1991 to 2007. So there are consequences. There is no free ride in this equation. And, of course, the future is set to repeat itself. We have Initiative Petition 40. And it's a wildly popular property crime and mandatory sentencing initiative. The cost, as I understand it, has not been determined by our legislative fiscal, but the Crime Commission has...
Citizens Crime Commission.
Yeah.
No.
Has put a price tag on it.
Criminal Justice Commission.
Criminal Justice Commission. Thank you, Madam Chair. A cost of anywhere from, $200-plus to $400 million per biennium. And it's set to go on the ballot this November at a time when we have declining revenues. So this issue emerges again for us. How can voters meaningfully decide that spending up to $400 million to lock up property criminals is more important than other critical services that their tax dollars provide? And that's the problem with the initiative process, is that decision-making is made in a vacuum. I would propose for your consideration, and that we will hopefully have this discussion continue into 2009, and I suspect that we will, is that, number one, we don't diminish the process, but we strengthen it. And the goal being to increase the knowledge of voters so that they are more informed, because I do fundamentally, and we all do. I mean, we're here at the pleasure of voters. We wouldn't have gotten here if they hadn't placed their trust in us. So inherently, there is that trust in the wisdom of voters. But what we need to do is to find a way to strengthen that knowledge base upon which they would then make a better informed decision. And the proposal specifically would follow along these lines. Once an initiative is certified, require that it be delivered to the legislature not less than 45 days prior to a regular session. Require the legislature to hold hearings, take testimony, and determine the intended and unintended consequences, including revenue and fiscal impacts. From someone that has had a lifetime outside this building and watching it peripherally, and now having been involved in it, my respect for representative government and the hearing process and the vetting process has just risen dramatically. The hearing process does work. I've gone into hearings, as you all have, with a bent one way, and you listen to testimony, and it brings you back to a little different position. And so the hearing process does work, and it sheds light on an issue. And we do try to find those unintended consequences as well as the intended consequences. And we do revenue impact statements, and we do fiscal impact statements. And then the other part of this proposal would be to require that the initiative be referred to both chambers so that we can have that debate on the floor, and that my constituents and your constituents would know what our position is on that initiative specifically. Now, that's a tough position to be. There are a lot of votes we'd like to just kind of not take, and in initiatives that could be one of them. But I think the electorate has a right to know where we stand. And then, of course, all of those findings that come out of hearings, that come out of, and you'd have, of course, the opportunity for a minority report to emerge along with a majority finding.
Senator Farioli is getting excited about the opportunity to do a minority report.
Madam Chairman, we will not always be in the minority.
Oh, you are so right.
Well, it'll take more than three members, Senator Farioli, of a committee.
That's
so
true.
So, but anyway, require that all these legislative findings then go into the voter's pamphlet. So the voters would have a greater knowledge base, more than just the 30-second sound bites and the little bits of Well, you know, campaigns quickly fall into demagoguery. Take a nugget of fact and truth and turn it into a distorted word. It's not, in fact, true. That, you know, that's part of the political process. But hopefully we would shed light on the initiative and provide a greater knowledge base for voters to make an informed, better informed decision. One thing I would suggest is that we do not provide the legislature the opportunity to amend the initiative, because that would be considered to be diminishing the direct democracy that is really held very sacred in this state. But we would have the opportunity to bring forward an alternative to that initiative based on maybe more informed judgment that would be provided voters the opportunity to make a selection between the original initiative and the referred ballot measure from the legislature. In conclusion, I believe that, again, we would be ill-served to deny anyone right of access through the initiative petition process, to constrict that or deny it. But I think our goal should be, from a legislative perspective, is how do we strengthen it? Because voters are wise, and they make, I think, good decisions. They make better decisions when they have better information, and that's essentially the essence of my comments. So, Madam Chair, members, I really appreciate the opportunity to share with you.
And I really appreciate you being here, particularly since you're feeling under the weather. I just think this is a very thoughtful and unique approach, and I would agree with you that voters are reluctant to deny, to limit access to the ballot. And so your suggestion of how we can make the process more thoughtful, provide more information to voters, I think is very useful. Sarah Montes Anderson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. My greatest concern, of course, is the impact on our meager funds that we have to deal with all of the needs that we have in Oregon. And to have most of the initiatives I feel that come forward are thoughtful, and they are, and the people who are bringing them forward are very passionate about them. Just as some of us are very passionate about health care, others are very passionate about land use, other people are passionate about public safety, and I truly feel that this initiative system has to change, because now that we're looking to 2008's corrections or public safety initiative, property crimes, however we want to describe it, is going to cost a huge amount of money, and it will have to come from healthcare and public education. It will. And it's just, and the public sounds good. Yes, we want everything, but we've got to pay for it.
Thank you. I agree with you that the fiscal impacts of these initiatives can be profound. And if we had the opportunity to bring it here in a more open forum and make those findings, to present to voters in a more clear manner that if you vote for something, quite often it means you're going to have to make choices about what is not funded or reduced in funding. And as I mentioned, the casualty of the wave of initiatives through the 90s, beginning with Measure 5 in 89, was higher education. The money just clearly wasn't there. And so now we're trying to dig our way out of that. So it's a dilemma.
Sir Farrelly, any comments?
None. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Will you be proposing maybe some legislation we can discuss in the 09 session regarding this?
Yes, I would be delighted to bring forward this concept in the form of a constitutional amendment resolution and get this discussion started. But I really think that the bottom line is that if we try to diminish the right of direct access, that it will not fly. And so that has to be abundantly clear, is that we want to strengthen the initiative process, not diminish it.
And Senator Morris, I'm just mindful of, I think, a constitutional referral we sent out, I'm guessing in 97, but it may have been 99, before, well, Senator Farrelly was here, which required, before an initiative got on the ballot, equal percentage of signatures from each congressional district. And the voters probably in Multnomah County soundly rejected that idea. So I think that gives credence to your argument. So have you had an opportunity to review the Portland
I was
City?
Just given that.
Okay, great.
This,
all right.
And I would look forward to reading it and working with all of the parties that are interested in advancing this, because I certainly am interested.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
All right, U of O students in the back room, what do you think? Is it a good proposal, his proposal? Do we need more information? Need more information. Okay, all right. You should know he represents Beaver Territory, so. All right.
I hate the idea, Madam Chair.
I know. All right, let's bring up Mr. Fickler, Mr. Cannon, and Mr. York.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Farrelly, I'm the acting Wade Fickler, whose voice is declining very quickly. He is the acting director of the City Club of Portland, so we've got double acting going on here.
And your real name for the record?
Richard. My name is Richard York. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm retired. I'm here today with David Cannon, fellow City Club member and fellow member of the committee that issued this report, which was approved and adopted by the City Club. We'll walk you through a 20-minute presentation that highlight the major conclusions and recommendations we make, which may sound like an echo chamber after listening to mm-hmm. Senator Morse. They're very, very close in both their text and intent. A little more than I think. This a little more than 2 years ago, the City Club initially embarked on an effort to update a 1996 report on the initiative and referendum system. The outcome of the effort is a new standalone report that builds on the history documented in the 1996 report and draws new conclusions and makes new recommendations that take into account the changes of the last now 12 years. The report was produced by 10 City Club members, including David and myself, all of us citizen volunteers who met through those 2 years, and David will go into the description of how we got to where we arrived. In the months since the report was released, it has produced news coverage, editorials, positive and negative, blog postings, and discussions around the state. The role of direct democracy, which you'll see we call it in the report, or the initiative, is on the minds of many Oregonians. They are concerned about the status quo. As you consider the many voices you will hear on this subject, please avoid the common mistake of assuming that the initiative reform is a partisan issue. It is not, unless it is made into one. The debate is more accurately between those who are completely satisfied with the system as it exists now and those who are not. And these positions, believe us, do not represent one party or another. I want to thank you very much for giving your attention to this topic. We really believe that reforming Oregon's initiative and referendum system is of the utmost importance to the economic and social welfare of our state and the well-being of its citizens. David?
Thank you. Madam Chair.
You guys have been working hard today. Are you losing your voice as well?
My name is David Cannon. I recently moved to Southwest Portland after 20 years in Clackamas County, 25 years in Oregon. Before that, I worked in a state that did not have the initiative and referendum, but that has in no way influenced my observations in Oregon, I'm sure. Madam Chair, Vice Chair Farrelly, and members of the committee, we're very pleased, honored, and in my case, somewhat surprised to be invited to share with you the City Club report during this brief session. But we think it's appropriate, and we want to commend you for doing so. We think this is a matter that's important enough for some of the reasons you've already heard from Senator Morse as well as others to begin the discussion and the statewide really discussion and debate that's going to be necessary if changes are to be made, and that it's really worth starting right now and not waiting until 2009. So thank you again. I think Rick adequately described our study charge for updating the 96 report of the City Club and looking at new developments and new uses of the initiative and referendum. So the first thing I want to do is just briefly describe the methodology of the study committee. And as I think you've already heard, we've spent almost 2 years. One of the things we did was extensive interviews, and we really had the luxury of doing over and over again what you just did, which was to invite someone who'd given a lot of thought to this issue to share those thoughts with us, with their observations. In addition to interviews, however, we reviewed existing material, scholarly research from their political scientists who studied the initiative throughout the country, historical data, news coverage, public documents, and, of course, prior City Club research. When it came to interviews, the point, I'm not going to read all these different categories of individuals that are up on the screen now, but you can see that we tried to get a very broad spectrum of people from different perspectives. We had signature gathering professionals, both those who work primarily for the conservative side of the spectrum and those who work for the more often for the other side of the political spectrum. We had people from rural Oregon as well as those from the larger counties to express what their reaction to what's happened with the initiative and referendum and make suggestions. It is clear, as Rick said, that this is not a typical partisan issue. There clearly have been critics and of the system as it now stands from various positions along the typical political spectrum, and also those who are very strongly wedded to seeing no change or certainly no more restrictions on the process from those who advocate using the ballot as a primary means of lawmaking, whether they're, again, conservatives or highly liberal or progressive, as they would describe themselves. So we had regional balance, political balance, and we certainly heard opinions, very similar opinions from people who were quite diverse. And we heard diverse opinions. The committee wants to summarize for you just the basic arguments, not necessarily for the system in its current form, but what were advanced as the primary reasons why we need to maintain the initiative system, why Oregon should have a strong citizens initiative and referral. The first falls into this category of direct democracy being considered a very superior form when we can provide it, superior to a strictly representative government. And clearly in Oregon we have a mixed system of lawmaking by direct democracy and representative democracy, unlike, say, the federal government where it's strictly representative. And I think the second large category of arguments for the system fall into the area that Senator Morse was addressing as well, that the initiative and referendum system has become and has been for 110 years almost an integral part of Oregon's political process. It's still popular, and therefore many feel it should not be abolished or even significantly weakened. And we feel, as Senator Morse did about his own proposal, that we are trying to strengthen and improve the system and in no means seeking to abolish it. So next, share with you some of the key concerns. You have a copy of our report, and I'm not sure if you received the executive summary, but there are copies by the door to the hearing room if you want to look at it. It summarizes concerns and goes into our findings and conclusions. So this is not as extensive a list, but I'll go through these because they're important, the ones that we pulled out. Let's see. First, the system as it now works generally offers minimal opportunities for effective compromise and deliberation. Secondly, the negative consequences of poorly drafted initiatives are a very significant concern for many, and you've heard both of those mentioned earlier today. Another area of widespread concern that I know you're very familiar with, more than any of us, is that our Constitution is now replete with laws of a statutory nature. We have, through this process, allowed ordinary matters of law and regulation to go beyond the reach of not only this legislature but future legislatures by putting it into the Constitution. So, and that's often been through citizen initiative or through direct intention of putting it beyond the legislature by writing into the Constitution these traditionally statutory matters. I think the thing that Senator Morris emphasized the most probably was the impact on the state's financial health, and we could not agree more. From probably the single biggest area of agreement among many, many folks who testified to our committee, and you can, by the way, the list of those that we heard from is in the report, and I encourage you to look and see who we spoke with. It did include a number of members of the House and Senate as well as others.
Can I hang on just a second? Yeah. I just wanted committee members to know that Marjorie has an electronic copy of this presentation, so
great.
If you want to have access to it later, you can.
So at this point, I'm not going to elaborate on the impact on the state's financial health. You had some good examples cited here already today. Another area of concern is the commercialization of the ballot measure process. And we chose the word today, commercialization, so that we wouldn't just say the money in politics. It's bigger than that. It's really that this machinery of the ballot measure in Oregon has spawned its own industry. And sometimes that has impacts that the community is not comfortable with. We found this is an issue that reaches right down to the level of those that are voting on initiatives and circulating them themselves, that one side accusing the other of this or that, and it's often cited that many of the individuals and businesses involved in this are from out of state. They're coming to Oregon and generating the topics themselves in order to stimulate this particular business that's quite profitable for them. We did see quite a bit of evidence of that. Final couple concerns, integrity of signature gathering process and the ballot certification process. There has been legislation in the form of House Bill 2082, which you passed last session, that addressed some of those concerns as well as others relating to the ballot measure process, and we found that to be helpful. And in fact, a couple of the recommendations we were ready to publish got taken out of our final draft because of that legislation. Nevertheless, there are still some real issues out there that we heard a lot of concerns expressed to us about details in these two processes. Well, at the end of the day, obviously the challenge that we found and that exists for the state is to find an appropriate balance between the role of elected lawmakers and the citizenry at large in the making of written law. We don't hear any significant proposals for eliminating the citizenry from playing a role in this, and we certainly are not advocating that ourselves. But we're seeking a better balance.
Can I just stop you right there? Anybody have any questions at this point? Sarah Ferrioli, Sanitization. I just think this is really interesting in terms of the this issue, and I really see the challenge for representative lawmaking as technology increases, that the challenge, frankly, between direct democracy and representative democracy is really the tension's going to grow as folks have better access to technology and can get information more rapidly. And I didn't know if either one of you had any comments on that. But essentially, at some point, I'm guessing in 10 years, we could essentially email out to our constituents the entire state budget and have them identify, you know, how they want to spend that in budget and get us the information of where how they would vote, and then we relay that information. You take that to the next level, and you have our citizens actually voting on the budget. And I think that's really the challenge we face in terms of representative democracy.
The one thing we point out in the report, I mean, the federal constitution is the model on which virtually all the states base their own constitutions. The federal constitution clearly calls for a representative democracy. And it's very clear about that. And the Federalist Papers and Federalist Paper 10 specifically addresses the issues of direct democracy versus, you know, representative democracy. And clearly there are issues both, but they've been adjudicated, and the Supreme Court has upheld direct democracy as a valid form of governance. So, you know, there's no way there have been thoughts of challenging it again. But those states in which the initiative exists, you know, consider it a fundamental part of their policymaking. So even if the Supreme Court were suddenly to say that it doesn't, that it isn't going to work, I think you'd probably have a federal constitutional amendment that would allow it, yeah. If that answers your question.
Thanks. Sure.
Yeah, I'd love to speculate about that point you brought up. I'm just going to go on and finish this.
I've got another question from Senator Farrielly.
We regress to the previous screen.
Sure.
Thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair. Wouldn't some or did some people argue that there is no appropriate balance or between elected lawmakers and the citizenry at large?
In what sense, sir?
Well, in the sense that people do not need permission to exercise constitutional rights. They're unabridged. They're, you know, guaranteed. They are inalienable. And therefore, to strike a balance between, you know, essentially the people whom we serve, mm-hmm. and the servants, which we are, mm-hmm. seems to me to be diminishing the citizen's constitutional right to a process. In other words, I guess insinuating lawmakers into this process by saying you're establishing a balance simply is a diminution of the citizen's rights.
I think I would agree with that if we were really talking that generally, but we were looking about lawmaking, and it's the role of the lawmakers and the role of the direct citizen vote in the making of written law. And in that sense, our tradition has been one of elected representatives through their process to make the written law. And we have created a balance in Oregon, as every 24 states have some balance between direct citizen voting and legislative lawmaking. 26 states have no role at all for the citizens in the direct writing of laws. So, theoretically, no, the elected representative would still be seen as a voice of the people, but in a different way, I guess, would be the answer.
Senator Farrielly.
I guess what I'm trying to get at here is that unless people have spent a little time with the frustration of finding the appropriate balance between the executive, the judicial, and the legislative branch, which are co-equal, they might have difficulty understanding that the appropriate balance between citizenry at large and making written law, which they have the right to do, conferred to them by a constitution they created. Mm-hmm. It isn't subsidiary to the rights of the legislature.
No.
It's, I guess you could say at best it's co-equal. In perhaps a better definition, all of these authorities are derived from the citizenry. So any attempt at abridging these, or it's sophistry to say that you're going to find a balance, because the fact of the matter is citizens have an absolute right to make law in the state of Oregon. They guaranteed it themselves in the Constitution.
And by the way, if you read through the report and the recommendations, categorically, we make no statement that will do anything to diminish that right. What we're looking for more than anything is what Senator Morse talked about, deliberation, so that both sides on a given issue can be heard. That initiative can go straight to the people. Exactly. It will go. In fact, it will go under our recommendations, and I believe under Senator Morse's, it will go exactly as written. there will be no change in that specific initiative. What we and Senator Morse both feel could also happen is if the legislature, in its wisdom, feels that there are changes that could be made that will make it either better to be executed, you know, by the government, that will provide better financing for it, they can, under both of our proposals, propose an alternative. But the original initiative goes to the voters as is. There is no diminution of that process. I hope that that's clear, because it wasn't necessarily clear to a lot of people who read the initial report.
Madam Chair, as we go through the recommendations, I'll want to engage in a dialogue on what I see is essentially what may be perceived as interference in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. What we have remaining is to summarize the conclusions of this study, this two-year study. Again, there's more detail in the report itself, and we'll just highlight what seem to be the most important conclusions. And this represents the consensus position of this study committee as adopted by the City Club on the whole. I'm not expressing my own personal opinions as I go through these. Oregon's initiative system, as it currently operates, is on balance a negative for the state. However, it is important that Oregonians retain for themselves an initiative pathway when the legislature is unable or unwilling to act on critical issues.
Madam Chair.
Sir Farrelly.
I'll go ahead and read the report.
Yeah, I think we're going to let it.
I don't want to belabor the point, but a sweeping generalization that on balance this is a negative thing for Oregon seems to me to be a little bit hyperbolic.
Yeah, that was debated considerably.
Extensively.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
All right.
And I guess the other thing.
And it really wasn't a statement that the system is negative, but that on balance, what the consequences, and that's why the demand for some changes is
And Madam Chair, to suggest that it is important for Oregonians to retain for themselves, gentlemen, I'm sorry, the Oregonians have already framed the Constitution. And to suggest that they somehow would have to obtain permission to retain for themselves some initiative pathway seems to me to be overreaching the process.
All right. I'm going to, if you want to go ahead and respond, fine, but I think we're going to need to move on to conclusions. They're going to be here all evening, which the students, I'm sure, would love to be, but...
Well, Madam Chair, if I might, just a brief response would be that I don't think we're arguing here, because it wasn't intended to suggest differently from what you're saying. We heard maybe this would clarify. We heard testimony from people who said that they would like to see the system eliminated. We saw this statement as a positive statement, essentially, that it be retained. That, of course, the legislature could refer a ballot measure that would change the Constitution and eliminate the initiative and referendum. We're simply making a statement that is within the power of an initiative by citizens or a referral by the legislature. Our statement is that we're not advocating that at all. So it's not a coming to you for permission to retain the system so much as responding to pros and cons. People for it, against it, saying our position is to retain it. That's all it is, I think. The second conclusion, we state it this way: Oregon's legislature has always been and rightly continues to be the state's principal means to lawmaking. However, relatively easy access to the initiative and referendum system has weakened the state's legislative process and lessened public appreciation for that process. We also found that the initiative and referendum system has decreased the will and the ability of the legislature to resolve significant policy and budget matters, which in turn tends to lead to even more reliance on initiatives and legislative referrals. We realize these are opinions that are not provable, but these are our conclusions. Number three, the use of what is sometimes called an indirect initiative system, something like what Senator Morse described, in other states reflects a very widely held view around the country that state legislatures ought to be involved in some way in the initiative process. There are 24 states, as I think I mentioned, which have some degree of an initiative. Oregon's is generally considered the most unrestricted and the most prolific in terms of its use. Certainly Oregon, Washington, California are the most used initiative systems. But there are 24 states. Many of them have significant limitations, such as that you can't, in our bordering state of Nevada, for example, you are not allowed to put on the ballot an initiative that would require the expenditure of funds. That being one of the more extreme limitations. Conclusion number four gets to a more specific point, which is what I think you could agree hopefully is a bit of an anomaly regarding the referral of constitutional amendments from the legislature being easier than the referral of statutory revenue measures. So current law, as you know, requiring a three-fifths majority to refer a statutory revenue measure to raise revenue, but you have been able to refer as constitutional amendments the same revenue measures. And we feel that that creates an inappropriate incentive for the legislature to refer amendments that were really revenue bills that failed. So that is an observation or conclusion. Poorly drafted measures produce significant, often negative, unintended consequences. Number six, to preempt the possibility of repeal by the legislature, the Oregon Constitution has been amended repeatedly in ways that would have been more appropriately addressed by legislative statutory enactment. And that's not just the revenue measures, but, of course, in many other ways, stemming from initiatives rather than referrals. And the final conclusions here are mandating the changes in revenue expenditure through the initiative system has, as we noted before, had quite an impact on our fiscal and revenue situation. It disrupts your budgeting process with the kind of impact that Senator Morse quoted with his figures. It makes it very difficult to fulfill your constitutional obligation to balance the budget. And we found that it definitely affects the state and local government bond ratings. And in regard to that latter point, I might just note that it is not even so much our existing law that has led to this lower bond rating for Oregon bonds, but the anticipation, the vulnerability, because of the way our initiative system works, that a measure, what is it, 40, that was alluded to, the sentencing measures, that at any time something like this can go through, no matter how much cost it may impose with money we don't have. And finally, the final one relates to the voter's pamphlet and the financial impact statements. There is a degree of inherent unreliability and lack of context for these financial impact statements, which really limits the voter's ability to make informed choices about the ballot measures, or really to deal with the trade-offs that, again, we were talking about, that you heard about earlier, with significant fiscal impact. And then we'll go right into the recommendations. And these are the matters that we're not trying to specify the form of bill or referral or initiative that would take to implement these, but simply to put the recommendations out there and leave it for you and others to consider and hopefully to implement in some means.
Question, Madam Chair.
Senator Ferriello.
Did you have a discussion relative to First Amendment rights in this question?
Absolutely.
What were some of the points of discussion or contention?
Oh, and regarding number one here?
Yes.
Number one relates to trying to restrict constitutional amendments to traditionally constitutional subjects, that is, the structure, powers, and limitations of government or the rights of the people. I don't recall a lot of discussion of this as a First Amendment issue, but I think it's a point that would have to be considered. How do you restrict the language or the suitability? I wondered that when some of these other states and how they've written their constitutions, where they say you may not have an initiative that does this, 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 or this, or this. Who decides? And yes, it is a restriction on lawmaking, if not on speech. But
it would require.
Yeah, I think the other interesting thing is that we're seeing fewer. My recollection in terms of the numbers in the last 10 years is that we had early 2000s, we had a number of constitutional amendments, and now if you look at the proportionality, the number of constitutional amendments are decreasing and they're more statutory.
For a few years, yeah. We have a table that does that. So, Armada seems to have had perhaps...
Well, that certainly had an impact.
It didn't we find that it has changed the balance between the number that are circulated but not the number making it to the ballot?
Yeah, actually, yeah. The number of constitutional initiatives... stayed about level. The ones that actually got qualified was reduced substantially. The people in general seem to be a little more wary in recent years of making changes to the Constitution. That would be on, oh, there's one on page 24.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's.
Yeah, that's the one. And, yeah. And, of course, last fall we went through a campaign in which opponents of a ballot measure used that argument.
Very effectively.
Very effectively.
Yeah. We had mixed feelings, some of us, about this.
Senator Farioli.
You know, I think I think a number of the constitutional amendments that are proposed, you rightly find, are proposed in that form because people want to keep the legislature's fingers out of the pie. Mm-hmm. And I understand that, but I guess to subject a screening process to the citizens' right of initiative seems to me to be limiting political speech, which is held at a much higher standard than any other form of speech in Oregon. Mm-hmm. So I think you may have proposed an issue that would directly challenge the Constitution.
Well, as I said, this change would require a constitutional amendment, which would have to be voted on by the people. Mm-hmm. I mean, in effect, you're asking the people to restrict their current privileges. You know, so that and I think we all know, sitting here, that it probably isn't going to happen.
I think the next the next series of recommendations have to do with the 3/5 majority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the second one, there was quite a bit of debate in our committee on this one. Mm-hmm. But we looked at standards for amending constitutions. Of course, there's the federal standard, which does require an extraordinary majority of the states, a number of states requiring extraordinary majorities in order to vote in a constitutional amendment. And the committee did recommend that for any amendment, we would require approval by a 3/5 majority of the votes cast, regardless of whether it came from a referral or an initiative.
Which may eliminate the need for the first recommendation, arguably. So.
But in itself would require a constitution.
Yeah, and I have no doubt that this is probably would be the most controversial. Many of those who totally agree with the background to all this are troubled by that recommendation because they'd like to get some of those things out of the Constitution that are currently there.
So are there other states in the United States that require a 3/5 majority for constitutional amendment?
Hold on.
60%, yeah.
Find that table.
Why don't you look at that?
There's a table. Okay, good.
There's a table.
I have to tell you, this is really a wealth of information.
Thank you. It's, you know, in my worst imaginings that none of it would ever be implemented, I feel good at least we have a good reference book. As a former teacher, that feels good.
Well,
the third recommendation for revenue, and this gets back to this very specific issue that you dealt with on Measure 49, I believe. For revenue measures proposed by the legislature, as long as the law requires a 3/5 majority to directly enact a statutory revenue measure or refer a statutory revenue measure to voters, we would require, if possible, the same 3/5 voting requirement of the legislature when referring the measure as a constitutional amendment. I don't know how that can be solved. I feel like somebody, well, that's getting into opinions. There could be a court case.
I actually think this is pretty interesting in light of the discussions that we had. If you go back to the testimony on the original referral from the legislature that required a supermajority for revenue increases, there is no discussion on the House side, and frankly, there's only one question on the Senate side. I believe my former senator, Shirley Gold, asked of whether this applied to initiatives, and the answer was clearly no. And clearly, the certified smart people in the building, the lawyers, disagree with that analysis. I do think, I may not disagree with you in terms of does this make sense given the light of what we're working with. I think a lot of folks might disagree with the underlying premise, and that is that we require a supermajority for a statutory referral.
If we heard correctly, and certainly we're a secondhand source, but our committee was told by someone that visited us that it was opinion of legislative counsel, but not necessarily of the constitutional attorneys that had been consulted
That's
by
correct.
The chair or of the attorney general or anyone like that.
That's correct.
No.
So I suspect we're looking at a legal challenge at some point.
Yeah.
And I think the other piece about when I saw this, I kind of chuckled. I'm like, you think the legislature is going to send out a constitutional referral on revenue increase in the future? I think we're a long ways away from that. So that was my other sort of response, that it's probably not necessary, but who knows? Go ahead.
Thanks,
I just wanted to point
yes,
out.
Yes, that's true.
If you look, it's not labeled page 16, but pages 16 and 17 are a chart that gives you a breakdown
okay.
of the various restrictions that many states have. And there's often a binary. They either allow constitutional amendments or they don't. There are a few that, for instance, in Mississippi, the initiative cannot be used to amend or repeal the Bill of Rights. And you can read this for yourselves, but there are serious restrictions in many of the other states which have the initiative on how the initiative can be used, you know, and in some cases they're not allowed in the Constitution at all.
I think the issue there are also facets of these states that are not described in this very brief summary, and
yeah.
some of that may have to do with the number of votes required for constitutional amendments.
Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what and I do understand what you're doing here. You're simply putting the referral by the legislature on the same basis as a direct enactment would be.
Yeah.
What we have in Oregon now, as the chairman referred to it earlier, the double majority, mm-hmm. that is you have to have 50% turnout and 51% vote to enact a tax. Are you proposing that voters would have to enact these measures also by a 3/5 majority?
No.
And if not,
no.
Why not?
Well, this one only applies to the legislature, recommendation number 3. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. That only applies to the legislature. That's your own rulemaking, essentially. I mean, it's your own rules that currently, and this has nothing to do with the popular vote. This only has to do with how a referral gets
I understand.
To the public. And,
I get
and you
that.
Are in control.
You made that abundantly
yeah.
clear.
Yeah.
My question is, if your objective here is to put the legislature and the citizens on equal footing,
oh.
on an initiative referral, wouldn't they then have to come up with a 3/5 majority to pass?
I would leave that completely to your own analysis, because I tend to think if the one is required, why not the other? These are severe impact, but that's not in the purview of this report. I think it's a logical question, but I don't think it was within our purview. You know, that would require, you know, major constitutional
change. There are a lot of different opinions. Some yeah. people would rather see the supermajority for the public vote. Some would rather see the supermajority for the referral in the legislature. Some neither, some both. And there are various combinations actually out there.
And that's
it's a good issue for discussion. But we're not proposing that there be a supermajority requirement in those cases, strictly because of this
great
rule
idea for initiative.
Okay, the fourth recommendation is, and I think we can do this fairly quickly because Senator Morse has proposed mm-hmm. essentially the same option, and it is somewhat complicated, but you've already heard about it, and that is that we recommend adoption of the indirect initiative system, which would require essentially two categories of things from the legislature. One, that there would be hearings for all citizen initiatives after they qualified for the ballot, or perhaps before final qualification, but after the signatures have been gathered, so that there would be no exceptions to that. Right now, this can happen, but it's not necessarily always the case. The second category has to do with the options of what the legislature might do or not do once you receive the initiative. Obviously, you could enact it into law exactly as proposed, and then there'd be no necessity of vote for the public to vote on it. That would not apply, of course, to constitutional initiatives where this Constitution requires the public to vote on it in any case. So, but you would also have some options. If the legislature did not choose to enact the initiative in the exact form you received it, you could enact a different law on the same subject. You could refer a competing alternative to the voters that would appear alongside the original. But the key thing that we want to point out, just as Senator Morse did, is that in no case does this give the legislature a veto. If I go out and get the required number of signatures on something that I've written as a law, it's going to go on the ballot, whether you like it or not. Unless I am able to withdraw it because you've done something satisfactory. That is the indirect initiative system.
I think it's been pretty interesting given the last couple of legislative sessions. We had a special session during last interim, and certainly we have a special session. That's what we're operating under now. And our ability to react or be proactive, however you want to say that, has really been enhanced by this annual session meeting time. And so for the last interim, we saw that on a couple of issues, payday lending and Jessica's law. This time around, you're probably going to see in a different form, I'm guessing, on ballot measure 40, which clearly already has the signatures. And I'm anticipating, we'll see, you might see a legislative referral out on the same issue, an alternative proposal, essentially doing this in practice, what you all have recommended. So I just think it's pretty interesting that these annual special sessions have really, in essence, provided this option. Senator Farrielly?
Madam Chair, I couldn't agree more. I think the description here is uncannily accurate for what may happen with IP 40.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting to me is that the discussions around the proaction of the legislature feed into the question of credibility of the legislature. Some folks will see that as meddling in a process mm-hmm. that we have no right to meddle into and picking the pocket of the petitioner. Other people will see that as attempting to get a handle on the unintended consequences and perhaps create a better reasoned outcome. Mm-hmm. In any case, voters are going to see these things possibly arrayed side by side with the attendant 45 or 50 arguments in favor and 45 or 50 arguments opposed. I'm not sure we're adding clarity.
I just want to make sure the students understand. I know that we've got some folks not from Oregon here, but do you understand what we're talking about in terms of the legislature reacting or proacting to the initiative process? Okay.
Somewhere.
All right, a little bit. All right. Well, a former legislator has introduced an initiative and gotten the signatures. It's a Get Tough on Crime ballot measure. It's very expensive. This is my words, not anyone else's. To the budget, estimating $200 to $400 million. The legislature is working on a alternative proposal, also Get Tough on Crime, though maybe not quite as tough, and providing treatment alternatives for property crime offenders that will be less expensive. Both are pretty likely at this point in time, I think, to appear on the ballot. That's essentially doing this indirect initiative system that the City Club is talking about. So I know the gal from Chicago probably doesn't have a sense because I don't think Illinois has a very active initiative system. One at all? None. Okay.
David is from.
Don't get me going on Illinois.
Okay. All right.
Illinois has a constitution that was written in 1970. It's a very modern constitution, and things are quite different. The initiative there is only allowed for the amending the legislative article of the Constitution.
Wow.
No other way, no other sort of subject matter for initiatives.
Okay.
Yeah, the current examples are interesting, and also we did some looking backwards, I think a lot of our witnesses did, to say, well, wow, if the legislature could have gotten its hands on Measure X or Measure Y 5 years ago or 10 or 15 years ago, they could have crafted something to accomplish the same thing, whether it be property tax limitations or land use issues, Measure 37. And then the counter argument is, well, the legislature could have done something, without waiting for an initiative. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, under this proposal, everyone would know that's where it's going to sit. The legislature would not be able to duck the issue entirely. It would be more apparent if it did. And you would have that opportunity. You would have to hold hearings. I think a lot more aspects of these measures would come out, the gray areas, more than just the black and white vote yes or vote no. And that's more than anything, I think, what we're seeking. Okay, there are just a few more specific, perhaps less sweeping recommendations. The legislature should strike ORS 250.035, paragraph 6, and make it clear that the Attorney General should assign the same ballot title to substantively identical proposed measures. I haven't mentioned the issue of ballot title shopping, but it does have a real impact on the process, and it is, if nothing else, very costly to state government. We're also recommending that the Supreme Court no longer hear challenges to ballot measure titles. I was surprised at the quantity of time and money, and we pay our justices too well, and they're too highly trained and experienced to have them spending all their time on ballot measure titles.
You're getting looks from state senators because up until this last year, our judges in Oregon were the lowest paid in the nation. So, they are a valuable resource, okay. And I do think assigning the Plan B judges to assume the responsibility of ballot title writing should make some sense.
I was quoting the administrator for the Supreme Court. Well paid to have them use his verb, diddling around with these things.
Okay, all right.
Okay. So you understand that recommendation. The Plan B judges have volunteered for extra work in their retirement. They would have binding say on them. Require that all proposed ballot measures be submitted to the Legislative Council for assistance in clarifying and drafting prior to the circulation of measures. This, too, would not be binding on the chief petitioners. It would be, I assume as a senator that you go to the Legislative Council, that may be required, but you don't have to draft the bill exactly as they recommend.
Correct.
And that would be the same with petitioners.
Senator Manus Anderson and then Senator Ferrioli.
There's a cost to using Legislative Council. And who would
represent? Well, we were informed this morning in the House committee that current law allows any citizen to go to the Legislative Council for assistance anytime they want a bill.
Through a legislator.
Yes.
And if you do it for the initiative process, you probably can go directly.
We didn't discuss the funding issue at all, Senator Anderson.
Yeah. But I do think if you're saving money and using Plan B judges, there's certainly, obviously different budgets, but there's certainly some trade-offs there. Senator Ferrioli.
In a perfect world, Legislative Council would draft exactly as you'd like them to draft, and in an imperfect world, which we live in, they do not do that.
Right. Well, the final say would rest with the petitioner. Mm-hmm. But in terms of some unintended consequences, which occasionally have indeed been unintended even by the sponsors of these measures, they might learn sooner in the process how they could avoid them. And finally, we're recommending that the state direct additional resources to enforcement of the laws that now exist. We said additional financial and personnel resources to proactive and vigorous enforcement of the regulations that govern signature gathering. That was what the press, the representatives of the Secretary of State and Attorney General all suggested to us, that they pretty much now had the laws that they need for the most part, but they simply had no resources to go out and deal with fraudulent practices, for example. So that's kind of an easy recommendation.
And I do think your comments earlier with the passage of Senate Bill 2082, which we finally refer to as IRMA, will certainly help. But I do think this analysis in terms of financial assistance to the Secretary of State's office. Mm.
We refer to it as Janus.
Janus?
Thompson.
Oh. That's pretty good. All right. Questions? Senator Ferrioli.
I think this has been a very valuable presentation. Very interesting discussion.
We hope it's thought-provoking.
It is thought-provoking. I hope that the City Club members of the panel also understand how often it is that well-drafted measures that are produced by this body often produce unintended and negative consequences. Mm-hmm. So
absolutely.
I don't know that you get a better product. But
That's very interesting when I'm talking particularly to lawyers about legislative work, and I just always warn everyone that crafting a bill is like dropping, or passing a bill is like dropping a small stone into a quiet pond, and that there's always ripple effects, and you never know what all the impacts are going to be.
Yeah.
So
your little two-word amendment can end up in a Supreme Court case a few years later.
Yeah.
No process is perfect, and we don't expect that this process would be any more perfect than the legislative. We do think that deliberation and consideration of measures would improve the initiative process, because that is not generally going on. We've got sound bites from both sides, and that's what people hear, and we think it would be beneficial to have consideration by the legislature in open public hearings where you hear both sides, and at least you've aired both sides, and you've examined through your own resources the fiscal consequences.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us here today. All right, next up, let's bring up Tyrone Reitman and Elliot Shuford from Healthy Democracy Oregon. Hi, and welcome. Do you guys have a PowerPoint, too?
We do.
Oh, wow. Okay. This is PowerPoint day.
We came prepared.
Oh. Can we get copies of that for staff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you have copies of the materials we brought?
No. Okay.
All right.
Great. Okay. I didn't see it. Okay. Thanks.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tyrone Reitman. I'm the co-director of Healthy Democracy Oregon. I currently live in Eugene. I was raised in Silverton, Oregon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a real pleasure to be meeting with you today. Healthy Democracy Oregon was created in order to promote an innovative reform of the initiative process called the Citizens Initiative Review. I'm going to briefly discuss why we're working on this reform, then turn it over to my colleague, Elliot Shuford, Healthy Democracy Oregon's other co-director. The initiative process, as you know, is designed to allow voters to directly shape public policy according to the public interest. In order to do this, voters must have access to high-quality information. We must be able to understand the issues of the day and must be able to determine whether a given ballot measure will serve the public good. Often enough, ballot measure campaigns, both for and against, present information which is sometimes spun, slanted, or at its worst, intentionally misleading. In much of the campaign literature and advertising, both for and against ballot measures, these complex issues with all their associated trade-offs and gray areas are drastically oversimplified. And voters are often left without a good understanding of what a given ballot measure will really do, let alone why it's been placed on the ballot in the first place. Ultimately, it is we, the voting public, who are responsible for making informed choices on ballot measures. I want to make that really clear. The initiative process requires that voters be responsible for the choices that we make. However, given the extent at which public relations firms and political consultants dominate the information flow in ballot measure campaigns, many voters don't feel they have sufficient information to truly evaluate the merits of the measures that come before us. And this is the problem the Citizens Initiative Review aims to address. We've already heard Senator Morris and the Portland City Club talk about increasing deliberation in the process. We think the Citizens Initiative Review is one more proposal to do that. It's designed to be a trustworthy, open public review process with widely publicized results, and we think it would assist the public in making informed choices come Election Day. So to describe the CIR process and background in more detail is Healthy Democracy Oregon's other co-director, Elliot Shuford.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Elliot Shuford. I live in Portland, Oregon. The Citizens Initiative Review.
Can I just stop you right there? Committee staff was telling me some information that I think might be helpful for committee members or just be aware of. Ms. Taylor, do you want to just repeat it for the record?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe that Healthy Democracy Oregon would like to let you know that Representative Buckley sponsored a bill last session related to the Citizen Initiative Review, and there was also an initiative petition that was It had a ballot title, but then was withdrawn.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, that's correct. Great.
And I should note that those two also have slight variations from what we're talking about today. But the Citizens Initiative Review is based on this concept of deliberative democracy. And here, just to kind of unpack that term a little bit, this is where the goal is to help the public move from a place of public opinion, which may or may not be considering the trade-offs and consequences of a particular decision, and public opinion may be a little bit unstable and based more on emotion, towards a place of informed public judgment that's based on common sense and reason and has carefully considered trade-offs. I want to share a few general notes about good deliberative processes. It should include a diversity of and a representative sample of the public. A good process should include a balanced range of expertise and information. Participants should learn about various policy options and then the trade-offs and consequences and public values and contextual issues with those particular policy options. And a trade moderator usually helps walk people through the process. Now, there's many different deliberative democracy models or approaches. The particular model that the Citizens Initiative Review is based on is called the Citizens Jury or the Citizens Panel. That's been used since 1974 in various policy contexts, ranging from local planning decisions on up to federal level decisions. Here's a quick overview to kind of give you a simple picture of how the Citizens Initiative Review works. A small group for each measure, statewide initiative measure that's on the ballot, a small group of randomly selected registered voters is convened. That group deliberates for 3 to 5 days as part of an open public hearing process, and then they issue a concise statement. The group then evaluates the process and disbands. So I want to get into each of those aspects in a little more detail. Selection of participants. A large pool of randomly selected registered voters, as I mentioned, is assembled. And then from that pool, for each measure, a panel of 18 to 24 people is developed. Then each of those panels is then balanced by demographics such as age, partisan affiliation, location of residence, and perhaps other demographics as well, including gender, ethnicity, income. Participants are compensated for their time, travel, and lodging, so there's no significant barrier to people participating in these reviews.
And who would pay for that, Madam Chair?
Chair Brown, Senator Montez Anderson, we see this operating as a state state-administered process, operating under an independent commission within state government, ideally. I should note also we're going to be demonstrating this process for a measure on next year's ballot, so I believe Tyrone is going to talk a little more about that at the end. But
great.
So into the deliberations themselves, over the 3 to 5 day period, the proponent team and the opponent team have equal time to make their case. They can also bring forward outside experts and witnesses to kind of help them make their case. And then there's an opportunity for a range of other experts to come in and testify and give input. The public is also has an opportunity to testify and give input and weigh in on the measure. Throughout the process, the citizen panelists ask questions, work in small groups, and have a chance to reflect on what they've learned. They also have an opportunity to call witnesses back if something is refuted, say, by the other side. If one side makes a claim that's then directly refuted, as we see in the arguments in the voters' pamphlet, for instance, the citizen panelists have an opportunity to carefully consider what they consider to be sort of the true fact in that particular instance. And throughout the process, participants make up their minds as to whether the measure will do what the proponents say it will do and whether it's a good solution to a statewide problem. Much of this then feeds into the Citizens Initiative Review Statement, or the CIR statement. And this is a really important part of the process, obviously. The panel drafts a simple, concise, one-page statement about that measure. That statement contains the number of panelists who are for the measure and the reasons underlying that position. The same goes for the panelists who are against that measure. They also have an opportunity to state kind of their opinion. And there's also space for any consensus or points on which the full panel agrees. If anyone's undecided at the end of the process, they also have an opportunity to explain why they're undecided. This statement goes up on the CIR website, is distributed to the media, and perhaps most importantly, put into a prominent new place in the voters' pamphlet. The statement is not written by campaigners or lawyers. It's not intended to be a unbiased or values-free statement. Rather, all public values on all sides are included. This is kind of the key difference between the CIR statement and the statements that are in the voter's pamphlet, the explanatory statement, fiscal impact statement. The statement is basically the voice of regular people written in everyday language with the goal of informing all Oregon voters. So it's not saying this is exactly how you should vote. It's information for people to consider in their own private deliberations.
Senator Farioli, hang on just a second. Go ahead.
So there, if I understood what you just said, it would be subjective.
It's subjective to the degree that the panelists themselves are offering their informed judgment.
So this is a focus group approach, random selection of people, and there's whatever subjective assessments they make would be given the imprimatur of legitimacy by the Healthy Democracy Oregon organization, published in the Voters Pamphlet.
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, it's different than a focus group in that, one, we wouldn't see ourselves running the process, and we are planning to do the demonstration as a way of showcasing the process, but we would see this as operating under an independent commission. It's different than a focus group in that it integrates a range of information and gives the participants opportunities to ask questions and learn as part of the process and deliberate with one another, and then also incorporate a range of different viewpoints. So the demographics of the people are balanced in the same way that a focus group might be balanced, but there's an opportunity for learning and deliberation is built into it.
I think what we're struggling with is that this sounds somewhat like the panel that's put together to craft the voter's pamphlet statement, okay, of the explanatory statement. And so I think what we're wrestling with is that's not what this is. That this panel is not to provide a concise, impartial, simple, and understandable statement explaining the measure, correct?
Chair Brown, concise, simple, and understandable would describe the CIR statement.
Okay.
But the participants are different in that they are randomly selected registered voters. So they don't necessarily have, I believe the comment was this morning, a dog in this show or an axe to grind.
A vested interest.
So a vested interest, right.
It's very different than the folks who are typically selected to craft the voters, the explanation statement.
Chair Brown, yes.
Okay.
I'm sure following.
Senator Farioli.
So we've established these folks don't have to be objective. They might be very subjective in their findings. How are the people appointed to the commission? Now, in the current circumstance, we have scrupulously tried to balance who it is that writes these voter pamphlet statements. You get, you know, one from column A and one from column B, and both chambers and both parties are represented, and then there's some neutrals. Who would make the appointments to the Citizen Initiative Review Panel, the commission?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, that's a great question. It really strikes at kind of the heart of the proposal. So there's the independent commission that oversees the operation.
Right.
And there would be staff members that would then actually make the selection process.
No, I'm not talking about the staff members selecting the 18 to 24 people that go on the individual measure committee. I'm talking about how to get on the commission that runs the whole show. You know, and if you're going to tell me these are gubernatorial appointments, I've got another place I need to be.
Chair Brown, Senator Fellio, I apologize for not answering that question directly. The current proposal that we have, the independent commission, and this is part of what we're working over right now, so any input you might have on this piece would be very welcome. The current structure that we have right now has four different sources for people on that panel. One is a group of political appointments balanced by both major parties. Another group is former moderators of the process. And the third group is former panelists, citizen panelists. And those latter two groups would be ones that were involved in the evaluation of previous citizen panels. So obviously this presents a little bit of a conundrum for the first round. But what we see is that there's a mix of citizens, people that understand the process, and people that understand state government, all providing oversight. That's how the independent commission is comprised in our current draft.
It does need some work.
We'd appreciate input on that. That's great. So this is essentially, the goal is to inform voters and provide some trustworthy information for people to then consider when they have a chance to vote. Some people have heard us talk about the Citizens Initiative Review and essentially asked, well, the process underlying it sounds good, but what impact do you really believe that the statement is going to have on how people vote? So last summer we worked with a polling firm and asked that two basic questions. One, do you read the voter's pamphlet? If so, how much time do you spend? As you can see, 83% of the voters said, I read the voter's pamphlet for 30 minutes or more. And I should note that that's kind of our target audience, is the people that are the mid-level consumers of information, the people that are willing to spend 30 minutes to 2 hours researching initiatives, not necessarily the folks that are willing to spend 15 or 20 hours, and not people that don't read the voter's pamphlet, but that's a smaller segment of the electorate. We also follow that question up with a question of, well, did that have any impact on how you voted? Did it change your mind on any initiatives? And 67% reported that reading the voter's pamphlet did change their mind on a few measures, at least a few measures. So now Tyrone is going to finish up with some more polling data and information about the initiative process.
So in trying to sort of encapsulize your concept, I think what you're trying to do is provide voters with more information before they proceed to vote on a ballot measure. Is that a fair statement? And do it through using average citizens. Is that a fair statement?
Chip Brown, that's correct. And I would add that an open public deliberation is a key part of that process. So, you know, you might see it on the closed caption TV, and that would be broadcast as well. The media would also have access to those deliberations and the products of those deliberations. So the coverage, the quality of coverage on initiatives could also go up a little bit.
I think Senator Farrell has raised some good concerns. I think I think cost is going to be an issue in terms of how to, you know, creating commission and, you know, what kind of expenses are we looking at. So I think those are a couple of things to consider. Senator Farrioli, some other things?
No, Madam Chair. I'll wait for the conclusion and then I'll ask two more questions.
Okay.
All right. Well, as a state, we've used the initiative process, obviously, time and time again since its inception over 100 years ago. It's well known and documented in multiple polls that Oregonians value the initiative process. So you see on the screen here, this is a poll that we had done in June 2007 by Davis, Hibbets, and Mitchell, which shows about 66% of voters, when asked, are you satisfied with the initiative process, respond yes. This is generally where that number lies. It has for quite some time in the research data that I've seen. So as you can see, the initiative process maintains a high level of support. However, numerous studies in Oregon, California, and Washington have pointed to the fact that while voters support the initiative process, there are also many areas where it could be improved. Specifically, some of the problems that come up in the research here in Oregon and elsewhere are the simple lack of information, not having enough information to feel that you can make an informed judgment on a ballot measure, you know, lack of understanding. The sense of buyer's remorse that when something is passed, unintended consequences come up, and voters later regret what's been passed. Misunderstood ballot titles is something that has come up before, where voters may intend to vote to support a measure, but in casting their vote, they're actually voting against the measure. Disturbingly, there's also a skepticism about public judgment that I've seen in a number of polls that basically relate when asked the question, do you feel your fellow voters have adequate information to make an informed choice? The vast majority say no. There's also cynicism about the role of special interests and the role of money in the initiative process, which is nothing new. So our goal in promoting the CIR is to add value to the initiative process by putting citizens in a lead role in evaluating ballot measures for the state at large. We think that by relying on a cross-section of everyday voters to provide additional information, information coming from a solid and trustworthy source, that the CIR is a really practical way to improve the initiative process. And our preliminary research shows that voters do support the concept. Before I conclude, I want to quickly address our next steps in developing the CIR. We often find in discussions about this idea that bringing together a cross-section of randomly selected citizens to deliberate on policy spurns a number of questions, ranging from, can everyday voters tackle these complex issues? You know, how can a public process be run in a fair and trustworthy manner? And as Elliot already mentioned, will this process really have an impact on the vote? Our research, our preliminary research, points to the efficacy and viability of the CIR as a reform of the initiative process. That said, references and research does pale to seeing the real thing. So while we look forward to answering any of your questions you may have today, we also want to let you know that we're going to be running a demonstration of the process this fall on one of the measures, perhaps two, that are on the ballot. So we invite you all to attend the demonstration process. Watch how it works. Watch the deliberations. Follow the results and examine the evaluations that take place once that process has been demonstrated. So with that, I want to thank you for your time and allowing us to present, and look forward to answering any of your questions.
Sir Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I have three questions, actually. The premise is one that I agree with. It's stated in the first page of your document. The ballot measure will, the panel would determine if the ballot measure will really do what its supporters claim it will. I think that is, you know, that probably leads to the greatest source of buyer's remorse, and it certainly does account for most, if not all, of the unintended consequences, because if it does what it says it's going to do, that's fine. If it does only what it says it does, that would be better. Mm-hmm. The second premise, if the ballot measure provides a good solution to a statewide problem, you know, obviously good solution is a really subjective kind of a judgment. So says who? You know, what? Please define what a good solution is for me.
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, I think the emphasis, the subjective term good in this context is the product of having citizens access quality information, have this, the opportunity to deliberate among themselves to define what a good solution is. So it's contextually based upon the information that everyday citizens have that are randomly selected that produce that result. So,
you know, we used to have a senator from Springfield, Senator Bill Dwyer, and his, one of his favorite statements was citizens have a right to be wrong. You know, and good is a good solution is certainly one that I agree with. All the rest are not. I just want to point that out. That you might work on that language. It's, you'll never convince me that somebody else's good solution will be my good solution. What is a special interest, please?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, special interest, I think, is in the eye of the beholder. I think it can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. If you think about special interest as an individual with a lot of money, special interest could be a citizen organization with a lot of members. I think the definition is pretty amorphous, but I think it does have a meaning to voters when they look at how the political process works.
Madam Chair, the folks that work in the United Way are a special interest. In this context, every place that I see special interest is connected with a serious negative connotation. Mm-hmm. So I would wonder whether or not you really know what special interests are, because you are one. And last, Madam Chair, the item 10, transparent and open process. This is probably the key to the CIR's credibility and whether or not Oregonians would embrace it or think it's just another special interest, mm-hmm. if I could use your term.
Sure.
The public must have access to reports, evaluations, and process of the CIR in order to maintain transparency and public trust for the process. My question, who is Healthy Democracy Oregon.org, and how are they funded? Who's paying for this project? And if it's by grant funds, from whence do these grants originate?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, we have a mix of funding. We're largely funded by a couple that lives in Washington State who are the progenitors of the citizens' jury process. So they've been working on this up in Washington State as well. Ned Crosby and Pat Benn. They've been very helpful. We're also doing door-to-door fundraising and direct mail as well. So we have a mix of funding, largely underwritten from those folks, and they've been great to work with because they've been providing us some of the expertise that underlies the deliberative process called the citizens' jury, and we're going to have the opportunity to do some training and work on a citizen jury that's upcoming in Minnesota this spring that'll help us do some of the demonstration in the fall. Our story of our organization is that Tyrone and I met in graduate school at University of Oregon in the Department of Public Planning and Policy, and that's where a lot of this came from. Tyrone has a background in initiative politics, and I have an interest in deliberative democracy. Actually, one of my former professors is here, Professor Ed Weeks, and that's his class on deliberative democracy. So I've been interested in this as a way of improving the dialogue around political debate in Oregon, and Tyrone sort of saw the need for that in the initiative process in particular. So, you know, we started working on this a few years ago and have been lucky to receive some funding to underwrite our activities.
Interesting.
Just, I really appreciate that background. I think, you know, you may be leading by example, you know, in a transparent and open process. I appreciate the disclosures. Madam Chair, it's just been my experience that folks who don't like the outcome want to change the process. And, you know, I understand there's a lot of people frustrated with the outcomes. So, voters' pamphlet statements, anybody can buy a page.
Thank you. I really appreciate you guys coming forward. Very interesting proposal. I look forward to having discussions, and I hope you'll invite senators and House members to some of the deliberations, the focus groups, so they can participate and get a sense of how it really works. I think it's very fascinating. So thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
So.
Chair Brown, thank you for the opportunity. Members of the committee, thank you.
With that, this may be our last meeting. We don't know whether we're going to get any more bills or not, but it's certainly our last formal meeting, so it was a very interesting note to end on. I appreciate the participation of the committee, folks from City Club, and folks from Healthy Democracy. And U of O students, you are our only spectators, or mostly only our spectators, so thanks very much for joining us today. And I'm sure my colleagues here would be happy to answer any questions or come down and participate in any future classes that you have if you are interested in having folks come to your class as well. So thank you very much. With that, I think we're adjourned. Keep our fingers crossed and stay tuned in terms of whether we get any bill referrals. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thank you.